Okay, so what we're doing today, this is the March 22nd version of our Daily Work of Daily Lives. Thank you all for coming. I'm John Beck. I co-direct our Daily Work of Daily Lives with my colleague, Kurt Dewhurst. First thing to remember is to sign in, please. So there's sign-in sheets that right behind you, Pam. You can start that one down this length, if you would. So let me announce that next Thursday is our second brown bag in the month of March. Delia Fernandez from the Department of History is going to be talking about I Want Equal Pay for Equal Work, Latinas and Black Women at Bell Telephone in Michigan, 1968 through 1980. And I was reminded, all of us would say Ma Bell for how long, right? And now we have children that never ever lived under something called the Bell system, so I'll just send those around. The second thing I'll send around is just for any of you who don't have the entire spring lineup, there are two in April. So please do take a copy of the spring rundown if you don't have it. I'm very glad that we're not playing basketball right at this time today. That's happened in the past. We had a departmental retreat, and basketball trumped all the other stuff that we were supposed to be talking about. So I felt very bad about that. I just want to point out, by the way, this is only the second time that Bill Greenwood has ever come without his wonderful wife, Kathy, in tow. So it is possible to come that way, Bill. You know, we can plan on that in the future. So today's talk is by Sean Wright, who's a PhD candidate here in the Department of History. Sean did his undergraduate work at Grand Valley. He was originally raised on the east side of Detroit, but moved to Heartland. If any of you have ever, you probably passed through Heartland at one point or another, because the fact 23 runs up from Ann Arbor right through the center of Heartland. But I think some people get off there. But maybe
pass through it is all you would do. You would just,
yeah. He did his work over at Grand Valley and then came here for his PhD in history. He's talking about arguably one of the more colorful and interesting characters in Michigan history in the 19th century. And that's always kind of a tough thing to do, because there are a lot of very colorful people in the 19th century in Michigan history. But he's talking about Hazen Pingree, so we'll hear about that in a moment as he takes us through potatoes, pennies, and Pingree, the working class and Detroit's progressive mayor at the turn of the 20th century. So please help me welcome Sean Wright.
Yes, thank you very much. And, you know, why Detroit history other than, you know, finding a fascinating topic like the one I'm going to walk you through? Well, both of my parents' families, you know, they migrated to Detroit. My mother's family were Hungarian immigrants who settled in Detroit during the Progressive Era in 1909. My father's family came up to Detroit from Appalachian Kentucky, you know, poor coal miners seeking work in the auto factories. And I can remember my father specifically always making sure I understood his background and where he grew up, being the actual city limits of Detroit in near the Chandler Park neighborhood, if you are familiar with it. He went to J. Finney High School. And one particular summer day after a Tigers game, he drove me around the entire city, showing me places where he's been, what he did, what he liked to do. And he made sure to stop by his childhood home in this Chandler Park neighborhood on the city's east side. And then I was 11 years old, so 2004, 2005, this kind of, you could imagine that it was once this beautiful big brick building that was unfortunately succumbing to the blight that so many homes have succumbed to thus far. And returning to that home several years later to still see if it was there, as I was a teenager, the home was gone. Right? The home was taken down with the kind of blight reforms being passed in the city. So in a way, I feel that by studying Detroit history and engaging, you know, interesting topics, in a way I'm able to kind of reclaim, you know, that home that was, that my father lost. So please, I would like to take you through this, what I find to be a really fascinating topic, and I hope you get something enlightened out of it today. Well, the following presentation is of research concerning my dissertation topic and its current and progress status. The overall point of inquiry here is investigating Detroit Mayor turned Michigan Governor Hazen S. Pingree and his relationship in life and death with working class supporters who endorsed his progressive era reforms with enthusiasm from the 1890s to the early 1900s. But investigating this topic unearthed a much larger cultural dynamic happening in Detroit at this time, which reveals a divisive, classist landscape populated not just by people, but by statues. With the recent nationwide debate surrounding Confederate statues across the South, a renewed interest regarding the place of monuments in our nation's history has arisen. City officials such as Mayor of New Orleans Mitch Landrieu are even called to action to comment on the place of these controversial statues in public spaces, reflected by his 2017 address to the city, calling to be rid of all these Confederate memorials by the end of the year. Statues are not simply benignly shaped pieces of artwork, as historian Michael Kamen in his Mystic Chords of Memory explains. Societies, in fact, reconstruct their past rather than faithfully record them, and they do so with the needs of contemporary culture clearly in mind, manipulating the past in order to mold the present. The majority of Confederate statues, for instance, were erected not immediately following the Civil War, but rather during the early 20th century as markers of white supremacy, funded in large part by those who shared this mindset and hoped to reestablish racial hierarchy. Statues nationwide, and not just those commemorating a racist past, ultimately possess the potential to reveal the historical skeletons hiding not so cleverly in America's closet. At the same time as the Jim Crow era impulse to erect monuments to a white supremacist Southern heritage hit its peak, two statues in progressive era Detroit were erected directly across from one another, unlike anywhere in the US, both then and now, signifying a symbolic clash no less substantial than the one represented by Confederate memorials. Though modern-day passersby may not notice, erected in Grand Circus Park in 1904 and 1912 respectively, the statues of the Republican ex-mayor and governor Hazen S. Pingree and the Democratic ex-mayor William C. Mayberry reflected two competing progressive-era visions for the city. While Mayberry's statue represented a reform-limited pro-industrial vision of Detroit's future, as it was funded largely by wealthy industrialists and political allies, Pingree's statue was spearheaded by the humble funds and enthusiasm of Detroit's working class population, symbolizing a reform-minded statue of the people, and most importantly, by the people. And here, courtesy of the Detroit Historical Society, we see a postcard from 1918 featuring the original placement of the Pingree statue on the left side of Woodward and the Mayberry statue on the right side of Woodward. Now today, these statues are just moved a couple yards in this direction, and they actually move the statues to where they no longer directly stare at one another, but their original placement here is seen staring directly at one another across Woodward. So what did these two politicians stand for that created motivations to build these two statues? Pingree's tenure as mayor and then governor from 1889 to 1901 was marked by a constant fight for reform measures that were meant to better the lives of non-elite Detroiters and Michiganders. He was not immediately a working class sympathizer, however. In 1886, just before he became mayor, workers at his shoe factory, Pingree and Smith Shoes, which he opened in Detroit after settling in the city after his service in the Civil War, workers went on strike for higher pay and better working conditions, only to be met by fierce resistance from Pingree. He succumbed to demands to place a union label on his products, but he did not increase wages. Soon after the strike, he underwent a political transformation as he was introduced to and became an advocate for Henry George's taxation policies, which advocated in part the taxation of unused land targeting primarily large corporate land holdings. Signaling Pingree's political transformation furthermore, during an 1891 streetcar worker strike resulting from protests over low wages, Mayor Pingree forced the railcar company to negotiate with the workers instead of calling in the military to stop the strikers. Establishing himself early on in his mayoralship as a corporate agitator and willing to empathize with the working class, the remainder of his political career was marked by his fight for cheaper gas utilities, cheaper railcar rates, and fair taxation that placed more burden on corporations, especially railroad corporations. Pingree became first and foremost concerned with growing corporate power at the expense of working peoples, and he expressed these concerns widely, including in a book he published while as mayor in 1895 called Facts and Opinions, or Dangers That Beset Us. His farewell address as governor in 1901 reflects his anti-corporate attitudes best, as well as highlighting the class tensions in society at the time. In the conclusion of his farewell address, he states, "My experience during my political life, extending over a period of 12 years, has convinced me that in order to secure the full commendation of those who consider themselves the better classes, the governor and other high officials must do nothing to antagonize the great corporations and the wealthy people. I am satisfied that I could have had the praise and support of our best citizens and our best society and of the press of the state generally if I had upheld those who have for years attempted to control legislation in their own interests, to the end that they might be relieved from sharing equally with the poor and lowly the burden of taxation. I would have been pronounced a good fellow and a great statesman." As this address shows, Pingree was all too aware of the classist landscape already ingrained in Detroit and Michigan at the time. Pingree became nationally known for his reform efforts and resistance of corporate power, as reflected really well by this political cartoon from 1899, drawn by a Louis Dalrymple, titled "An Unequal Contest, They Can Find No Flaw in His Armor." And you can see here this large, kind of indestructible knighted figure titled Truss, being protected by the shield of the Constitution of the United States. And here, in this lower right-hand corner, we can see Pingree with pistol and hat in hand. And if you notice, you can see some other key progressive era figures in the image. Behind Pingree is T.R., Theodore Roosevelt. Interesting that Pingree actually captures the foreground of the shot rather than T.R. And also William Jennings Bryan is featured here as well. Arguably the most emblematic of his reforms was the Pingree Potato Patch Scheme, where during the economic panic of 1893, he opened nearly 430 acres of city land for poor and working Detroiters to farm to subsist themselves. Many of these peoples were recent Polish and German immigrants who made up nearly 15% of the city's population at the turn of the 20th century, according to sociologist Olivier Zooms. The potato went on to become a symbol of Pingree, and his reform efforts being featured in Pingree campaign ads, including Pingree campaign sheet music consisting of songs about the potato patches. The potatoes allowed to be grown would ultimately translate into pennies given to Pingree's memorial upon his death, a topic I will return to very shortly. And this image really encapsulates this concept that potatoes allowed to be grown by these immigrants would eventually result in some kind of commemoration for Pingree, right? We can read the sign here in this field, the name of the man who originated this system, the potato patches, will be handed down to posterity. As for William C. Mayberry, his career as Detroit mayor developed alongside opposition to Pingree. The Pingree-Mayberry political rivalry became a reality when Mayberry defeated Pingree's hand-picked successor for mayor in 1897. Pingree even denounced Mayberry during the 1897 mayoral campaign in Detroit by saying, "Gentlemen, all I gotta say is that what Detroit needs is a man for mayor who will tell those public utilities to kiss something else besides babies." I know. It's fun to laugh at, yeah. Mayberry served as mayor for one term longer than Pingree. From 1898 to 1906, which is a testament to his political skills, and he certainly cultivated goodwill among Detroiters as a mild-mannered, shy man, the exact opposite of Pingree. Mayberry, however, broke with Pingree's pro-reform, anti-corporate power attitudes and embraced a pro-business vision for the city, represented in part by a stewardship over Detroit's becoming a major manufacturing hub in the early 1900s. Mayberry presided over the Greater Detroit Movement as mayor, which was the process by which the city enlarged its territory by annexing surrounding towns and villages, such as the Delray neighborhood. One crucial benefit of this process was made evident by a Wallace Franklin writing into the Detroit Free Press in an October 13, 1903 edition. "If Delray had been in the city limits, the striking iron workers would not have so badly beaten the man they followed from the Penobscot building. It is but one instance of what better police protection would do." The Greater Detroit Movement clearly had designs to protect business interests, particularly those pertaining to manufacturing, by ensuring greater resources in combating labor unrest. In addition to these larger pro-industry plans, Mayberry personally provided his friend Henry Ford with a loan to start his first car company, the Detroit Automobile Company, in 1899. Mayberry orchestrated the downfall of legislation that would ban automotives from city streets due to the threat to horse and carriages, thus opening the door for future auto development. In crystallizing Mayberry's instrumental role in building Detroit industries, the Free Press stated in 1912, "The late Mr. Mayberry was undoubtedly largely responsible for fathering the industry that has made Detroit the greatest producer of electric motor cars as well as gasoline in the entire world." Knowing what and who Pingree and Mayberry supported during their political careers leads us to investigating who supported and funded each statue, which ultimately unveils a cultural landscape in the turn of the 20th century, Detroit divided by class. Upon his death in 1903, as a result of intestinal cancer, calls for a Pingree memorial began pouring in from working class Detroiters barely after the ex-mayor's body turned cold. Newspapers remarked on the outpouring of support for a statue to be built to Pingree, with many of these calls coming from the same people who he fought for during his political career. Even across the international border in Windsor, Canada, these observations were clear, as stated by Windsor City Clerk Stephen Lusted. "Prominent citizens have a good word to say about the dead man, but is especially among the laboring classes where tribute to his worth can be heard." Looking into those who donated based on newspaper accounts and cross-referencing these names and dollar amounts with census records from 1900, paying close attention to occupational status, we start to develop a glimpse into the base of Pingree statue supporters. What we ultimately see is a largely working-class base of supporters, many among them immigrants who donated cents and small dollar amounts. The press itself was well aware of this class dynamic, as newspapers from Spokane, Washington to Detroit ran the same story, reporting that the subscription list contained the names of few men of wealth. The subscription list, however, did contain the names of many poor Polish laborers or struggling widows who remembered Pingree for the municipal potato patches. So let's go ahead and look at some of the profiles of these donors. Here taking one specific example so I can illustrate what specifically I did with these census documents. So seeing names in these subscription lists, I then cross-referenced these names with census record information from the closest census year database, this being 1900. So we have the name here of Charles Monk, donated a dollar, going through the census records and finding these names. Now, I only tried to select names that I knew where there weren't duplicates, so I could try to be as specific and accurate as possible. Now, where multiple names do occur, for instance, with Charles Monk here, you can get into looking at the age differentials between these duplicates. For instance, with Charles Monk here, the only other duplicate was a child still in school. Therefore, I'm able to reasonably determine that the person donating this dollar to the Pingree statue is probably the adult Charles Monk. And we see here, written in the census data, year of birth, but also where he was born, Germany, where his father was born, Germany, where his mother was born, Germany as well. The year they immigrated, 1865. And his occupation, which is very important, butcher. Now, of course, Charles Monk is not the only example of this. There are several others on the specific subscription list from June 25th, 1901, that I'll walk you through. So we know Charles Monk was a butcher, German immigrant, donated $1. Amy D. Gray, a school teacher, donated $1 and was a Canadian immigrant. Peter P. Miller was a cigar maker, born to German parents, in Pennsylvania, and we see here that Mr. Miller donated $1. Charles A. Watson, a saloon keeper, born in Canada, also donated $1. And saloon keeping is really interesting, looking through how this process of commemoration between these two statues played out. Because the newspaper accounts that talked about Pingree's commemoration process, they talked a lot about the decisions to go into taverns to collect money. There was a big debate about that that played out. Whereas with Mayberry, there was a stern resistance against collecting money from tavern keepers, saloon keepers, thus further illustrating the class dynamics at play here between these two figures and their statues. A couple more. James Cutting at the bottom here was a stove maker and an English immigrant, donated $1. And then Lewis McHenry, right above him, was a coachman, native to Michigan, donated 10 cents. Others profiled, not listed in this specific subscription list, feature the Speck family, all born in Germany, who built and sold furniture. Klaus Speck was the carpenter, and his brothers Dietrich and Jacob were the salesmen. They all donated $1 apiece. George Mailer, born in Canada to German parents, was a construction foreman who donated $1. His nephew George Zinn, also born in Canada, was a day laborer and donated $1. And lastly, Charles Frey, born to German parents in Michigan, was a shoemaker like Pingree was, who donated $5. Now, this is not to say Pingree's statue did not receive large dollar amounts. You see here a couple large dollar amounts in the middle of the subscription list. But when in comparison to Mayberry's subscription list, which I will show you very shortly, the class differences are all too unavoidable. When we read particularly the inscription on the Pingree Monument pedestal, we see a perfect unison between Pingree's reform-minded crusade and the common Detroiters who literally paved the way for his memorial. The inscription reads, as shown here, "The citizens of Michigan erect this monument to the cherished memory of Hazen S. Pingree, a gallant soldier, an enterprising and successful citizen, Four times elected mayor of Detroit, twice governor of Michigan. He was the first to warn the people of the great danger threatened by powerful private corporations, and the first to awake to the great inequalities in taxation and to initiate steps for reform. The idol of the people. It is noteworthy that the more controversial the inscription becomes, the smaller the font size gets. And we see here the part referencing dangerous, powerful private corporations and unequal taxation, clearly in the smallest, obscurest font size on the inscription, suggesting a conscientious attempt to possibly minimize its impact. Nonetheless, its very presence in the inscription sends a powerful message, as no other progressive era monument possesses such a really bold reformist statement. And we can even look at other statues of other kind of key progressive era figures from the time to kind of think about this as well. Shown here is famous progressive era mayor of Cleveland, Tom L. Johnson. And we see here the book he is holding is Henry George's Progress and Poverty. There, it does not possess the same kind of, you could say, in-your-face inscription that the Pingree monument possesses. Whereas calls for a Pingree memorial began pouring in from working-class Detroiters immediately, support for the Mayberry Memorial revealed a more covert process. In tandem with Mayberry's close political and personal confidant, Police Commissioner George W. Fowle, the pro-democratic Detroit Free Press initiated calls for a Mayberry monument upon his death in 1901. This before any public support for a Mayberry memorial, as had occurred more spontaneously with Pingree. In June of 1909, the paper editorialized, "The erection of a monument of high artistic merit in a public space where it can be seen of all men is, however, something in which we can all agree." Mayor Phil Brittmeyer seconded the newspaper's proclamation. "I heartily favor the idea suggested by the Free Press. I will do all in my power, both as mayor of the city and privately, to aid such a movement." Contrary to the Free Press's confidence, however, not everyone agreed. Detroiters began writing into the Free Press questioning the need for a Mayberry statue. One anonymous Detroiter wrote a letter to the editor asking of the Detroit Free Press, "Why should he, Mayberry, be singled out for such honor? What did he do for the progress of Detroit or its betterment? I am not deprecating the good man's qualities, but public memorials should be reserved for those who do something distinctive for their country, their city." In addition, a Reverend J.M. Barclay of Pontiac, pastor of the Forest Avenue Presbyterian Church, questioned the initiative to build a monument to Mayberry as well, and said so in a sermon, saying, "The recognition given to William C. Mayberry is due to a form of hysteria, and as such is wholly at variance with proper equilibrium of public mind." In both cases, the Free Press responded with a lengthy rebuke of both concerns, showering praise on Mayberry. Even the Free Press, though, at times recognized the need to tread carefully with the public in their efforts to cultivate support for a Mayberry monument. As in May of 1909, the paper stated, "The people of the city would not desire to have the Mayberry monument outshine the Pingree monument." Just as with the Pingree Monument, examining the names and dollar amounts available as published in newspapers and cross-referencing these names with 1910 census information ultimately reveals a base of support for the Mayberry statue made up of wealthy industrialists and political allies who donated much larger increments of money than Pingree supporters did. In addition, many of these industrialists were associated with staples of Detroit's economy and cultural makeup throughout the 20th and 21st century. For example, founder of the Peninsular Stove Company, Jeremiah Dwyer, donated $100, Detroit being the largest stove producer in the U.S. at the time. Fred Sanders of Sanders Confectionery gave $100. former U.S. House of Representative and major Packard Car Company investor Truman H. Newberry donated $100. Frank J. Navin, owner of the Detroit Tigers from 1908 to 1935, donated $25. Alfred Lucking, former U.S. House Representative and General Counsel to the Ford Motor Company, as well as Henry Ford's personal attorney, provided $100 to the Mayberry Monument as well. The Ford Motor Company's first major financial backer and lumber baron, William H. Murphy, donated $100. Vice President of General Motors at the time, E.O. Wood, donated $100. There's a pattern here. Joseph L. Hudson of Hudson Department Store and Hudson Motor Car Company fame donated $100. And finally, James Verner of Verner's Ginger Ale donated, how much do you think he donated?
$100.
He donated $5. So it makes you think twice about drinking a nice cool ginger ale knowing how cheap the man was. That was. Mayberry's subscription list is heavily populated by these wealthy donors, and a $100 donation was not uncommon, as just illustrated. Looking deeper than the large $100 donations by industrialists and political friends, we still see a funding base for the Mayberry Monument populated by upper-class individuals, frequently from non-immigrant backgrounds, who commonly had household servants, further demonstrating their wealthy status. Now, these examples include one Andrew C. Wood and his son Hugh J. Wood, who here again, cross-referencing these names on a subscription list with actual physical census record information from 1910, we see their names. This case, these were the only two individuals with these names in the census record for this time. We see Andrew C. Wood here, the father, the head of the family, born in Ohio, father from Ohio, mother from Ohio, a merchant in what industry? Oil, an oil merchant. His son, who donated an additional $5 on top of his father's $23 donation, he was an attorney. Born in Michigan, father from Ohio, mother from Scotland. And we can look at several more names listed here in this subscription list I have also profiled to reveal to you. Horatio N. Hovey, H. N. Hovey, who donated $25, born in Michigan to parents from the U.S. Northeast, was a lumber merchant. He also had two household servants. Oh, that's right. I definitely want to show you. And here, we can see where they have servants. Listed under the head of the household, son, daughter, servant, and their information. Looking down here, we can see how they classify themselves. One, a cook, private family. Another, a homemaid, private family. This is all too common in these Mayberry subscription lists. Edward W. Pendleton, right here, donating another $25, was a pharmacist born in New York to parents from New York. Judge Henry H. Swan, found here on the subscription list, donated $15. Of course, he was a judge born in Michigan to a father from New York and a German mother. Edwin A. Birch, from England. He was a wholesale merchant, donated $23, and had two servants. Richard P. Joy, featured here, donated $25, was president of the National Bank in Detroit, had five servants, and was born in Michigan to parents from the U.S. Northeast. Now, looking visually at the subscription list for Pingree and Mayberry side by side really illustrates the class divisions just on paper. And of course, knowing some of the occupational statuses of these people, we know even furthermore that class is a big factor in who's donating to which statue. So we see here on the left, Pingree, dollar, 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 you know, 50 cents, 10 cents, a lot of single dollar donations. On the right, large dollar increments, 100, 100, 100, 100, 100, all throughout here, 25, 25, 25, 25, 25. Making the couple larger donations that Pingree received by wealthier donors, you know, more irrelevant when you put the two subscription lists side by side. The cultural and classist battles over these two statues extended into the art world as well. In 1909, University of Chicago art historian George Breed Zug attacked the Pingree statue for being unremarkable. He said, "Where's the dignity of eternal life in that statue? Look at the ugly shape of the pedestal. Think of the mechanical lettering and the bad taste in the English used in the text on the statue. Consider the lack of dignity and the ordinary everyday nature of the work." Everyday nature of the work. Zug issues a classist rebuke of the Pingree monument as he purposefully targets the ordinary everyday nature of the Pingree statue, an affront to the everyday people who largely funded the monument. This attack did not go unnoticed, as the Detroit Journal responded to Zug's criticisms. The people wanted a statue of Pingree. Who wanted a Roman toga or a Hebrew mantle or a precise dress of any sort? They wanted Pingree, and this the sculptor gave them. While Pingree's statue suffered from attack, the Mayberry Monument received more positive attention. From the very beginning of plans to erect a Mayberry statue, the thought was to have the statue be aesthetically superior to the Pingree Monument, as Detroit Art Museum director A.H. Griffith noted. He said, "Mayberry's statue, without being larger or more pretentious than the Pingree bronze, should be a genuine work of art, erected and executed by the best sculptor who could be obtained." Upon the monument's completion in 1912, Griffith confirmed his earlier remarks and described the statue as a work of art and true to life, further illustrating the class differences between the two statues. Mayberry's statue comes equipped with the relief composed of pink Tennessee marble, behind him featuring the toga-wrapped figures of charity and eloquence. Whereas the art world criticized the Pingree monument for resembling a common everyday portrayal of Pingree, absent the refinement of classical antiquity, Mayberry's statue satisfied their classical and Victorian aesthetic desires, and quite literally as well, due to the presence of the marble relief figures invoking classical antiquity. In conclusion, today's two Detroits, represented by the difference between downtown, mostly white-owned business interests, and the much poorer and blacker city neighborhoods, are manifest in most urban areas across the U.S. Though without the racial aspects, such a stark national division highlighted by contemporary Detroit is not that dissimilar from that which divided the nation in the early 20th century and manifested itself in the two Detroits of the progressive era, between the reformist and anti-corporate power vision of Pingree and the pro-business vision of Mayberry. Arguably, the greatest lesson to learn from this historical episode is that progressive era working peoples did not just organize to challenge corporate influence, unresponsive politicians, or poor quality of life conditions. They cemented their struggle in statue form. And in response, others of a more elite background sought to combat this vision, the struggle with one of their own. Continuing to investigate this progressive era cultural and classist battleground will hopefully facilitate a discussion regarding not just the battle over the soul of an American city, but an American nation. Thank you.
Well, fascinating stuff. So why don't we open it up for questions or comments?
What about the $100 donation to remove the statue from the Detroit Food Press Company?
Yeah.
That stood out among the others.
Mm-hmm.
The Food Press did that. More for paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't notice any other newspaper contribution. I knew
there was. And the more you look through, say, Mayberry's people, the more you'll see their connections to newspapers and other industries. But I'm glad you really you asked this question about the Free Press contributing to Pingree, giving $100, a big donation. And it's really interesting because Pingree and the Free Press, like you mentioned, they did not have a very good relationship while Pingree was alive. So it makes you think why? What would motivate the Free Press to give money? Are they trying to illustrate to this kind of large mass appeal the Pingree statue and say, okay, we got to jump on this and and donate to show our goodwill? Or is it a kind of, you know, backhanded compliment or some kind of backhanded insult to the man, the fact that an institution he spent his whole political career battling would in the end donate a good sum of money to a statue? It's a really good question and something definitely that I'll keep thinking about.
Well, just in passing, you've got previously acknowledged on the other list, you know, over nearly $7,000 mm-hmm. in contributions. Do we know how much the Free Press gave to the Mayberry statue?
There is no, from the subscription list that I've found so far in the documents, there is no Free Press donation. But when you look at the names, and you just research the names, whether it be, you know, just a quick Google search or actually in the census records, there you'll see newspapermen mm-hmm. donating, but not necessarily saying which specific newspaper they're donating from.
Okay. Jim?
Well, further on that conversation, do you think there's any chance the Free Press didn't want to alienate subscribers who are working class people? They must have bought a lot more newspapers because there are a lot more workers than were the elite.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I think that is an absolutely credible approach in taking and thinking about why the Free Press would donate that money due to the fact that they probably do have a large base of working class readers.
Okay, my second question was, do you have any knowledge of who actually circulated the Pingree fundraising? Because, you know, you could raise that kind of money in one afternoon at the Detroit Athletic Club for Mayberry, but who actually went into the saloons and solicited 10 cents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it a union or was it a group?
So you have, what you have happening here, both statues have what is called kind of like a commemoration group in charge of doing the fundraising and it's sending out the envelopes to places to collect this money. To your question, what I know most in that regard is with Pingree, they are going to taverns, they're going to saloon keepers, and what I mean by that is they're giving these saloon keepers basically like envelopes in which to donate money for people who then attend the saloon. That owner of that bar already has the kind of documentation in place to receive donations. And you have both of these statues, both of these kind of commemoration bodies also used, they would send out this same kind of envelope for these fund collections to kind of pharmacies, general stores, basically any business or industry that wrote into the newspaper asking that they'd like to have, you know, some kind of donation bucket, donation envelope.
Okay, Jim.
First a suggestion, then a question. Suggestion. I was fascinated by that side-by-side picture of the Pingree Monument and the Mayberry Monument. Yes, that one. I'm struck that the Pingree Monument, I realize the Prince Rupert Park is not the world's great place, despite the brown beach. But the Pingree Monument, you know, it opens back to a tribute natural setting. The Mayberry Monument basically has a stone wall behind his back, separating from the natural realm. I realize that, you know, architectural criticism is probably not part of your job description as a history grad student, but
it could be.
I'm in but I urge you to do more reflection on just what the total aesthetic context may say about that scene. Because to me, that's a fascinating side by side.
Yeah, absolutely. The kind of art aspect of this was something I came upon rather recently, and it's a really fascinating component of this. That again, I'm not extremely familiar with, but it's something I absolutely want to explore and want to know more about, because you have art people commentating on these things.
Here's the question, pretty straightforward. In some ways, Mayberry was lucky that he beat it out of town, politically speaking, in 1906, because then came the Baker Panic of 1907, which might have cut short his political career had he been the mayor through it. But my question is, I didn't see any bankers or any bankers or, you know, financial type people on the Mayberry donor list. And I just wondered where I presume the banking community was lining up pretty solidly with Mayberry, but I just, wondering if any evidence came your way as you've been researching.
Oh yeah, this figure right here, Richard P. Joy, was president of the National Bank in Detroit, who donated $25. And there are other figures too affiliated with banks that I just chose. I chose more of representative profiles to show you. But certainly financiers and bankers are definitely a part of Mayberry's backing.
Now, two quick questions that others might have on their mind as well. How much did the two statues actually cost by comparison? And if you could help us understand those committees, because, you know, if you see a list of who's on a committee, that can be fairly significant in terms of who these people are backing the two different statues. Do you have information on both those questions?
Yes. Could you repeat the first part of that?
So the first is, what did each cost?
Gotcha.
Because that helps you understand how much has been raised. And then on the other side, who's on the committee in both cases?
As for the cost, the Pingree Monument costs about $13,600, whereas the Mayberry Monument exceeded $20,000 in the $23,000 range. And that's another interesting part to do further research on. Because you have people in the Mayberry commemorative camp talking amongst themselves, saying, you know, Pingree costs this much, can we really get this much out of it for this statue? You know, they kind of boast it up, saying, no, this monument's gonna cost less than the Pingree Monument, to try to assuage fears as if the Mayberry statue is in some way going to, again, outshine the Pingree Monument, when actually the Mayberry Monument is several thousand dollars more expensive than the Pingree statue.
And about the committee structure?
Yeah, and the committee structure, again, a really good question and something to do more work on. But I will show you, for instance, so these commemoration bodies kind of in charge of at least guiding, you know, where these envelopes and fundraising, what they do, where they go. There's tons of people. Lots and lots of people, and it's usually people affiliated with their political camps during their political careers. And for Pingree, you see Carl E. Schmidt here, who donated $50. He was the head of Pingree's kind of commemoration group. And he, Carl E. Schmidt, he was really into kind of environmental reform and bringing back Michigan forest after the degradation of the lumber mill. As for Mayberry, the gentleman that I mentioned in the speech, this police commissioner and personal confidant, George W. Fowle, he was the head of Mayberry's kind of commemoration group. And I don't have the exact names in front of me, but you do see kind of some overlaps with people who are a part of commemoration groups donating and being featured on these subscription lists.
Okay, Pam?
Growing up in Detroit, Free Press and the Detroit News were a competition with one another. Do you have any idea what the Detroit News slant was on these two statues? They were established in 1873.
The Detroit News was? This was mainly free. The archives that I have access to are dominated by Free Press materials.
Well, they were established in 1831.
Mm-hmm. And the Detroit News materials I've had a much tougher time accessing because they're not featured on newspapers.com, and they're not really prominent in other kind of databases that I get access through as a student. At least where I'm at right now, I could be completely wrong about that. But getting access to the Detroit News and other newspapers at the time is certainly a priority.
Okay, right here. Oh wait, we've got right here, then over to you, Jim, but right here first.
Footnote on what she said. Check the State Library of Michigan collections, because they have direct access to both Detroit News and Detroit Free Press. I'm working with those and some other newspapers down there right now, and the State Library of Michigan newspaper collections and microfilm reels are vast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, right here.
Oh, I've got State Archives has a lot of Detroit News stuff, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, John.
That was a really good presentation. I learned a lot. And as someone who is not an American historian, I'm going to ask you a question that maybe isn't totally fair, but it has to do with the way that you're looking at your census records.
Uh-huh.
And in many ways, the story that you told is an American one, but also a non-American one, mm-hmm. based on immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really fascinated by these kind of donations, the way that you're looking at these immigrants and people that have come from immigrant families. I'm wondering, when you were going through these census records, if you found any kind of particularity towards a certain group or a certain country that immigrants came from that tended to donate money. So, you know, did you find like more Germans,
mm-hmm.
that were donating, or perhaps Hungarians, as you were talking about with your own family? There's a large Polish population,
yeah.
in Detroit at this time as well, Ukrainians as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you found any kind of emphasis on certain groups or ethnic minorities that were in favor of donating, or perhaps ethnic groups that didn't donate.
Mm-hmm.
You saw kind of what wasn't there.
Yeah, that's a great question. In the ones that I profiled for today, and the ones that I've looked at that I didn't choose to include here, the dominant immigrant group that you do see for Pingree is certainly this kind of central Eastern European immigrant. This mainly German, but you do see Polish background in there as well. And again, that's contrasted with what you see with Mayberry, which is a lot of times you do have, you know, the occasional immigrant, but it's usually, you know, Anglo-Saxon. And but a lot of the times these are people native to the U.S. with parents native to the U.S., born largely in the U.S. Northeast. But again, the immigrant aspect of this is another thing that I just like to keep running with, because it helps to make it more of an international story.
Too. Yeah.
Tim, you had your hand up?
Just wondering if you've been to the Bentley Archives at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's just briefly so far, but with this kind of being the initial stages of where I see the directions for my research taking, the Bentley is a huge priority, top priority for sure.
Bob?
Was there any text on the Mayberry pedestal for the statue?
Only, there's no text. You do see here, it doesn't come through really well, but it says his name right here. William Cotter Mayberry. That's the only text you see. Again, which is interesting, back to the relief here, you know, what does the relief say behind him that is different from, say, what the inscription kind of explicitly says over here? And just dissecting this art world aspect further is, I'm sure, just going to be so much more complex and interesting than I originally thought.
Well, and let me, right here.
How was the placement of the statues determined, and is it a coincidence that they were directly?
See, that is, I haven't found, I'll go back to the original placement with the postcard. And you see, again, yeah, the direct placement, they're literally like basically looking at each other's eyes. What you see people talking about, writing about, and particularly the newspapers, is it's Pingries gets put up, and then when Mayberry gets put up, people are like, oh, we can, let's put it across from Pingree. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that, you know, be a nice thing to do, keep our statues close together in this one area? But, you know, I see that as, again, a space competing for kind of remembrance, you know, particularly.
These committees
determine the placement, but what I'd really like to find, if it's out there, is this kind of political behind the scenes machinations where you have, say, the Mayberry camp saying, yeah, we're gonna show Pingree, we're gonna put it right across from him so we can claim this space differently from Pingree. So this, Pingree's is right here, and Mayberry's is over here. Again, this is the original placement. Today, if you were to see these statues, they are just further down here, several yards. They were. Mayberry's religion is prominent in the sources. They talk him up as, you know, a God-fearing man, as a proper Christian, way more than they do Pingree, probably for good reason. But certainly the religious aspect with Pingree is very, with Mayberry is very strong.
Mm-hmm. Let me raise a question historically, and there are a lot of other people in the room who can easily answer it, I'm sure. And that is that all of us were raised on the whole notion that the 1896 election was when Democrats became Republicans and Republicans became Democrats. So that you have, you know, with the William Jennings Bryan run at that point. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in Pingree's relationship to the national Republicans other than TR, right? Yeah. So the non-progressive kind of Republicans. Mm-hmm. And I'm also interested because others were raising issues of ethnic background, but the Democratic Party was, at various times, was primarily Catholic, mm-hmm. In the urban centers.
Yeah.
You know, Irish and Polish and other things. So can you help us understand a bit about where do these two men fit into kind of the national scene when it comes to Republicans and Democrats? Mm-hmm. Because it sounds like Mayberry is as a pro-business Democrat, in effect, that would change very quickly in the, mm-hmm. you know, in the 1912 election, I assume, with some of the things that happened in Michigan. So, just in nationally. So just help us understand kind of the political complexion of this.
Yeah, and the kind of larger, the relationship between local politics and national politics, again, is another subject that I need to do more research on. But from what I do know, Pingree, he learned, he was not a trained politician, right? The Republican Party in Michigan came to him first to run against the Democratic ticket, ad, thinking they can run him on this, look, he's a good businessman, kind of Republican ticket. And with the rising immigrant population in Detroit, with these Eastern European immigrants kind of flooding Detroit at this time, he calls on kind of outside Republicans and learns how to kind of go into these taverns, these saloons, where these German Polish immigrants are, and he learns how to talk to them on their level, right? You see that in the sources, right? This is a strategy, trying to take away what has long been a kind of democratic stronghold, being immigrants. I can't speak a great deal as to the relationship to the local politics in connection to national politics, unfortunately. But you do have, with Pingree, he becomes so popular in this kind of local Detroit realm. His name gets floated around for president before TR's name gets floated around for president. And he rubs a lot of kind of older career politician Republicans the wrong way. Take, for instance, Michigan Senator James McMillan. In Congress, in the nation's capital at the same time as Pingree's in office. Those two, you know, despise one another. So Pingree did not have, he did not have a great relationship with kind of classic older Republican leadership. He was more so kind of forging a more individualized path, which again is something well worth looking more into.
Okay, back here, Jim.
Well, congratulations on your interest in this. We'll look forward to your thesis. Would you consider this idea? We all know the reverence that people have in the South for Confederate monuments. I liked your start of your talk by bringing up that subject and the almost godlike reverence they have for the heroes of the South. Now, I know that military people always get more text or mileage than politicians. Mm-hmm. After the Pingree statue, the money was raised, a beautiful statue's done, mm-hmm. and it's in a public park. Were there any follow-up? Was that a rallying point for civil rights or egalitarian progressive movements? Or my point is, was it just a one-shot deal, or did it
Yeah, that's a great question. And with the research I have done on that, again, another topic rich with further information to get into. But what I do know is this is one of the rather more unfortunate parts of the research is you don't really see either one of these statues, particularly Pingree, becoming this rallying cry for, say, a Walter Reuther or the Union movement in Detroit. You just don't see that. If anything, you see both of these statues constantly being threatened by war drives to take the metal from these statues to use for the war effort. And that is, and there's a great photo of with the Detroit bankruptcy, right? The recent bankruptcy, both of those statues had for sale signs hung around their necks. And if anything, the one moment where Pingree's name does get talked about in the kind of legacy, if you will, is during the Great Depression and New Deal efforts. But whereas you would think, you know, people would talk about Pingree and maybe association with these programs to help alleviate the suffering of working peoples, you know, some of these newspaper writers look to they kind of warp Pingree's political career and say, no, he'd be on the side of getting rid of this taxation that's being imposed on the Detroit populace to raise money for these new programs. So it's that kind of legacy aspect is really wacky, but certainly the war drives comes up a lot, and the fact that they so quickly succumb to, you know, not to say nothingness, but you just don't see a sustained rally around Pingree's statue. Yes?
Follow up on the legacy questions. We live
Yeah, I would, one of the big priorities for me is how national can I take this? How much can I relate this to these larger national themes like a deindustrialization, like a national, the local political party system? But particularly given Detroit's place as kind of the deindustrialized capital of the world, I think that makes that issue all the more potent and ripe with you know, research opportunities given the classist nature of these two statues. Yeah.
That poses the issue, one of the issues, very starkly. From the 1920s through probably at least late 1950s, And so what you're getting hold of here is a potential contrast that's absolutely stark and painful, because Detroit now has become a sort of, you know, handicapped poster child for deindustrialization.
Yeah. And right, you reflect on the kind of cultural logo map I made of, you know, people affiliated with these industries, right, who donated and were strongly supportive of the Mayberry statue. Again, a lot of these, again, go on Ford, GM, Packard. A lot of these are spearheading Detroit's industrialization in the early and mid-1900s. So industrialization is absolutely tied in to what's going on between these two statues.
Yeah, just one quick aside based on something you said and said something put in with Jim saying. Henry Ford was a really interesting guy. And, you know, and all sorts of stuff about Ford, you know, anything from the anti-Semitism to who knows what else. But what's fascinating about his focus on the village industry plants that he puts all over the state of Michigan is this combination of kind of urban and rural that's really in Ford's background. So it's fascinating to think about the fact that just in the 1890s, a number of people would have been already farming plots within, you know, they would have had chickens, they would have had maybe other kinds of animals, still I think in certain parts of the city of Detroit. Mm-hmm. Now, what Pingree ends up doing is, in effect, kind of, we might call it nationalizing, even though it was local, mm-hmm. You know, available land to give it to people who might be landless to be able to farm, right?
Yes.
So it's interesting just from the point of view that here's an urban mayor who is, in effect, harking back to a rural past for a lot of these mm-hmm. folks, because a lot of these folks, you can't turn around and farm if you don't have that necessarily as your background. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward to today, when there's probably more arable land in Detroit than going back prior to this period.
Yeah.
Right? So I mean, there's all sorts of interesting complexities.
Yeah, these potato patches, I mean, these pick up nationally and even internationally as well. You have, you know, other cities, newspapers commenting, right? Boston, Philadelphia. They all pick up on the potato patch, this scheme due to the 1894 Depression, and you even have an article by the Free Press talking about how during World War I they mentioned that these Berlin women were, right, they say they were adopting the Pingree potato patches, you know, to help subsist themselves during the First World War in Germany. So yeah, again, another area just ripe with really interesting caveats and nuances.
Any last questions? Any last questions? Well, let us give Sean another round of applause. I'm sure all of us, you know, didn't know that we were coming to a talk that would have statues, in effect, at its base. No pun intended. Do come back next Thursday for Delia Fernandez talking about Michigan Bell Workers. And if you haven't already signed in, sign in, please. And we look forward to seeing you at all of our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives activities. Thanks.